Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in African Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Sarah Katz, a postdoc at Duke University, and the host for this episode. Today, I'll be speaking with Dr. Paul Naylor about his new book, From Rebels to Rulers, Writing Legitimacy in the Early Sokoto State, which was published by James Curry in 2021. Dr. Naylor is currently a cataloger of West African manuscripts at the Hill Museum and Manuscript Library, Minnesota. He has previously taught at Loyola University Chicago and Tulane University. Dr. Naylor, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much.
So to start, I'd like to give you a chance to kind of introduce yourself. How did you become interested in history kind of more broadly? And then how did you come to focus on the pre-colonial history of Sokoto? And sort of specifically, how did you decide to kind of hone in on the kind of more earlier years of the Sokoto state?
Yeah, sure. So I got my BA in Arabic from University of London, SOAS. And after that, I didn't really pursue academia for a while. I was in media and translation, so mostly like Arabic documentary films in Arabic that I would do subtitles and stuff for. So really sort of loosely based on history, but more on the Arabic language side. And then I applied for collaborative doctoral partnership scheme. So this is a UK scheme that links up universities with research institutions, so like libraries or museums. So in my case, it was University of Birmingham and the British Library, and it already had a title, Islam in West Africa. So I could choose within that, but I was kind of introduced to that through the scheme. So my supervisor Benedetta Rossi focuses mainly on the Hausa region. At the British Library, I was cataloging their collection of manuscripts from West Africa, mostly from northern Nigeria. And Sokoto was the largest state in terms of like the written heritage that exists. So it all kind of logically came together like that. And so when I started reading through, you know, what had been written about Sokoto already, and there's a lot, I saw that most of it focused on, you know, the historical events and the chronology of the early state, but there'd been very little engagement with the manuscripts themselves. They'd just been used as kind of primary sources in order to tell this events-based history. And it was clear that these intellectual documents spoke to each other. They changed, over the first 30 years. And I wanted to look into that in my thesis work that later became this book.
So as sort of mentioned, you know, the topic of your book is the pre-colonial Sokoto state. So for people who are maybe listening who know little to nothing about this topic, can you just sort of sketch out the broad strokes for them? So kind of, you know, where are we talking about, how long it lasted, the kind of basic political structure and so on?
Yeah, sure. So the movement began in the Hausa kingdoms, so Hausa land, which is in present-day northern Nigeria. And so these were small states governed by kings, the about seven of them. And they gradually incorporated Islam into their identity over time. And so Usman was actually the tutor to one of these Hausa rulers, the ruler of Gobir, But he later became known as a kind of traveling preacher and teacher who began to call for a radical reform of society. And so Sokoto, what we call today Sokoto, was founded in 1804 after Usman declared jihad, a religious war, against the rulers of the house estates. And this led to a series of rebellions across Hausaland and across northern Nigeria, present-day northern Nigeria, by Fulani. So he identified as Fulani, which is one of the groups, ethnic groups of West Africa, but also other people. And the wars destroyed the entirety of the house estates and really changed the geopolitical landscape of the whole Sahel region. So Usman, and then after him, his son, Mohamed Bello, tried to kind of unite all of these disparate territories together into a single theocracy governed by themselves as Amir al-Mu'mineen, or Commander of the Faithful. And so Sokoto was constructed in 1810 as a capital city, but most of the early rulers spent their time in these frontier regions of the Sokoto state, these kind of frontier fortress towns. And government was extremely decentralized. So the old house estates kept their capitals. They would just had an emir that was appointed by the Emir al-Mu'mineen in Sokoto and pledged allegiance to him. But other than that, they were more or less independent. And also lots of regions that were not part of these original house estates had emirships created by Sokoto. So it was very decentralized. The Sokoto state lasted around 100 years until 1903, when Britain annexed the territory and created the Protectorate of Northern Nigeria. So although the British maintained and actually strengthened much of these government structures that emerged during those 100 years, they remained more or less as they were under what the British called a native authority under the doctrine of indirect rule. So today there's still a Sultan of Sokoto, there are still plenty of regional emirs, which along with other traditional rulers play an important role in domestic politics today. And this has had very important consequences for the historiography of Sokoto, which I'm sure we'll talk about later on.
Another bit of background that I think might be helpful is to kind of go over a couple of terms that you use. So the first is the Fodiawa. Kind of what is that? What does that represent?
Right. Yeah, the Fodiawa is a term, adopted by myself and a few other scholars, just really in an attempt to show that Usman Danfodio, his younger brother Abdullahi Danfodio, and Mohamed Bello, the son of Usman, are linked genealogically, but not necessarily in terms of ideology, because others have used the term triumvirate or something like this, which suggests that they somehow governed, collectively. And so I tried to show that, there were lots of divisions between these three men, over the course of the early history of Sokoto in terms of the best way to govern the territory. So Fodiawa was my attempt to kind of create almost like a family name. So Hausa Wa is for plurals of ethnic and social groups. So Fodiawa is like an attempt to give them a family name and not suggest any other kind of ideological adherence. Yeah. So.
And then second, if people have heard of Sokoto, they've probably heard it referred to as the Sokoto Caliphate. But for the most part, you reject the term caliphate and instead go with Sokoto State. So kind of why is that an important distinction for you?
It's important because in the Islamic legal tradition, the caliphate or khilafah suggests this kind of global representation of the Muslim ummah. And it has to be bestowed by somebody upon a caliph, So it has to be given to them by a previous caliph or through a genealogical link to the early Muslim community, to Muhammad himself. And so Usman, the main reason is that Usman himself very explicitly said, I'm not a caliph, and in fact tried to ally himself with the various caliphates that were in the region at the time. So whereas the Ottomans, through their representatives in Tripoli and in Egypt, or also the Alawite dynasty of Morocco, who claimed to be caliphs because of their genealogical link with Prophet Muhammad. And so it was only really later in the 1820s onwards when Mohamed Bello claimed that Usman had been a caliph. But again, this was a really specific debate between him and Ahmed Lobo, who was trying to create his own caliphate in the Mopti region of Mali. So it was a very controversial term, because if you claimed that you were a caliph, you also wanted all of the local Muslim leaders and rulers to pay allegiance to you. And as far as I can tell, the term Sokoto Caliphate was created in the 1960s by Murray Last, after the publication of his famous book, The Sokoto Caliphate, 1967, which remains a very important and well-read work for Sokoto's early history. And I think he chose this title either simply because it sounded very impressive, and it was the kind of impressive pre-colonial history that was required by northern political elites in Nigeria at that time, as they sought to create an independent country based on their own genealogical links to Sokoto's founding father, and they envisioned that it would be a country led by these northern elites. And so it's these kind of complex political contexts that I'm trying to talk about in the rest of the book.
All right, so now that we're sort of grounded a bit, let's get into the book. So the heart of the book kind of begins in the 1790s, when Usman Danforio, the founder of the Sokoto state, is sort of producing writings that are part of what you term discourses of dissent, that kind of lay the ground for the jihad that will kind of ultimately bring about the Sokoto state. So what are kind of some of the key parts of these discourses of dissent?
Yeah, sure. And before I talk about the discourse of dissent specifically, I want to first kind of bring some context as to how, historians usually frame revolutionary Muslim social movements in West Africa and in fact other places. So the story is there are these reformers seeking to return an orthodox Islam to the region which is dominated by the syncretic practices or the kind of debased practices of ruling elites. So this is exactly the story that, of course, the jihadists told them. So the historians are just kind of, aside from this problematic aspects of this, just recycling the victor narrative, fixating on the concept of Islamic orthodoxy really obscures the what to my mind is one of the most important tools of legitimization, which is changing the narrative of what orthodox means. So in line with your political needs. And that's exactly what the Fodiawa did. So at first, they said, look, there is this orthodox Islam, which we follow, and an adulterated inferior Islam, which your opponents follow. And so the only way to achieve justice in this life and also to fulfill God's will for a perfect Muslim society is to overthrow these rulers and follow us. Otherwise, your own, we might start to question whether you yourself are a good Muslim if you don't want to follow this orthodox Islam. So it's a very effective tool, really weaponized by this idea of takfir, which is that, if labeling other Muslims, non-Muslims, or apostates from the faith based on their actions. And so these ideas were not new to House Land in the 19th century. They've been used for centuries by weak actors to overthrow seemingly powerful political elites, ever since really the ulama split, or the scholars split from the caliph in the very early history of Islam. So this is one element of the discourse of dissent, really derived from these Islamic legal arguments about takfir, and about obedience or non-obedience to a non-Muslim ruler. But it was also combined with other elements that had success at a more popular level, so such as claims that Usman was the Mahdi, the Islamic Messiah, that is expected to come at the end of time. So the idea that the world is going to end soon, the idea that he'd met directly with Abdul Qadir Jilani, who's the founder of the Qadiriyya Sufi order, which was the most popular in the region at the time. And so he's kind of bypassed the hierarchies of Baraka that existed in the region. And so you have to go directly to Usman if you want to receive all these spiritual insights. And so there are all these elements work together to create this really kind of quick overturning of the political order.
You also discuss in this chapter how, there was some disagreement during the early 1800s within the discourses of dissent. And so I realize it will be hard for us to cover kind of all of this, but kind of maybe provide one or two examples of sort of the Fodiwa kind of disagreeing.
Yeah, so I mean, the example that I can think of is the Mahdi, like I just talked about. So Usman did not deny that he was the Mahdi or that all these similarities his followers pointed out between he and the Mahdi. He did not say that these were untrue. He also followed predictions that the end of the world would come in 1200 of the Hijri calendar. So that's in the 1790s, right at the time when he started to militate against the Hausa. So he cultivated this millenarian fervor. His younger brother, on the other hand, was really not a fan of this. And he said very clearly that he didn't think that Usman was the Mahdi and that only God knows who the Mahdi is and who and when he will arrive. And so you have, you know, Usman and Bello saying, look, the Mahdi is going to come very soon. And then even within the jihadist camp, you have his brother saying, well, actually, that's not true. And many people wrote to Abdullahi and to Usman asking, well, which is it then? You know, so it created a lot of problems.
Hmm. All right. So the first part of your book's title, Rebels to Rulers, reflects the fact that after the Furiawa had sort of more or less taken over, they needed to shift from the position of sort of critiquing the existing power structure to then kind of legitimating their rule and effectively leading. And part of what helped them accomplish this was sort of what you term discourses of moderation. So what are some of the kind of the key parts of the discourses of moderation?
Yes, yeah, so you can imagine that, you know, given all of the elements I discussed before, you know, this is a kind of recipe for this constant anarchy, because whoever takes control could then themselves be labeled a bad ruler or a bad Muslim and or an apostate and overthrown again. So, you know, they really had to change the discourse they started before against the House of Kings and establish a stable system of government with them at the head of it. And so they borrowed a lot from the House of Kings before them. And so they introduced a lot of things which before they had suggested were non-Muslim, such as, you know, the kind of large court life and titles and all these things we'll probably talk about later with the Hausification of Sokoto. But you know, basically what they said is, look, now we have orthodox rule. Orthodox Islam is what you have now. So any attempt to rebel against that is not justified, is in fact fitna, or you're creating anarchy. And so when people use the same arguments that, oh, well, the Furiawa have now become these tyrannical rulers, they said, look, the best way is to obey the strongest ruler, even if he rules contrary to Islam, because this is the lesser of two evils. So this was a kind of legal maxim they used again and again, which of course they didn't apply a couple of decades before when we're talking about the House of Kings. And so again, you know, this wasn't a new argument. You know, it had been employed, this lesser of two evils concept had been employed to recognize since the Abbasid period that there wasn't really a centralized caliphal power anymore. And there were going to be these regional governments that claimed all sorts of powers and authorities that was not written in the Quran or other documents. And so that's the legal side. Just like with the discourse of dissent, there was a legal side derived from Islamic law. But, you know, on these other two concepts, which I call in the book Kashf and Nasab. So, you know, Usman said, well, okay, actually, I'm not the Mahdi. We don't know when he's going to come. But he will come soon. So they wanted to control this Mahdist, you know, they kind of utilize this dynamic force, but not have it be so anarchic. So they said, well, he's going to come, but he's not going to come yet. And Bello actually said, he's coming, but in 1863. So essentially leaving his kind of successors to deal with this problem of the millenarianism that they'd created a couple of decades before. And likewise, in terms of the ethnic group, the Turabbi Fulani, you know, previously they'd said, oh, we are the ancestors of Arab conquerors in the region. We have a rightful place in Hausa land. Now they said, no, you know, the Fulani are just one of many African peoples of the region as they sought to try to integrate non-Fulani back into the government. So we see all these kind of changes happening at the same time, which I try to call moderation.
And again, just like we sort of saw with the discourses of dissent, you know, there's plenty of disagreement within the discourses of moderation. So what's one example of this that you found kind of particularly interesting?
There's an interesting legal concept that you see cropping up in Usman's work in the 1810, 1815 or something, when they're just trying to establish this centralized government. And it's called Inkar al-Haram, which basically is like, you cannot declare haram, you cannot outlaw anything which another scholar has permitted at some point in time. And so we can imagine, you know, if you read around a bit, most things have been permitted, you know, that are not explicitly against Islam, have been permitted by some scholar at some point. And so this allowed Usman to excuse all sorts of things that happened in the jihad, which were not following Muslim law. So you can imagine, you know, stealing and killing Muslims who were remained in the conflict zone and did not clearly side with the jihadists, wearing gold and silver, displaying all sorts of luxurious clothes that they'd taken from the house of rulers, you know, all sorts of things. And so for each of them, he found an example in the hadith or in Islamic law that permitted these actions in very specific circumstances. And so this demonstrated how knowledgeable he was in Islamic law, and it also preserved his authority in the eyes of his followers to say, look, this wasn't anarchy, you know, this was all legal, you know, this was all okay. Abdullahi was not, again, he was not a pragmatist, he was not a politician. He didn't realize or he didn't care that it would be much easier to find ways to excuse these actions. He was a legal purist. And so he was threatening this whole Sokoto project based on this idea of a return to Islamic orthodoxy by saying a lot of these things that happened weren't actually correct in Islam. So again, this caused a lot of problems down the line for their legitimacy.
All right, so then kind of the next stage of the Sokoto state is the death of Usman Danforio in 1817, and then the kind of succession of Muhammad Bello, one of his children. What are a few of the key reasons this succession was sort of somewhat controversial, and then why does it kind of give way to a second jihad from 1817 to 1821?
Yeah, sure. So again, we have to, and this is going to be a theme, you know, I think in a discussion, we have to go back in time, you know, to find out why hereditary succession was so controversial in Islam. And so, you know, Muawiyah, you know, way back in the 7th century, named his son Yazid as successor in Damascus, and this started the Umayyad dynasty. And for Muslim historians, this kind of brought an end to the period of rightly guided caliphs following Prophet Muhammad. And so when Bello claimed to be the successor of his father in Sokoto, 2 weeks later, Abdullahi wrote a very long document in which he criticized the succession. 6 weeks later, I think Bello wrote a response. Neither man kind of referenced the other and said, you know, what you're doing is wrong. And they both used actually the very same books of Abbasid kind of legal manuals as each other. But you can see how they work with this material, that they took very different positions, not just on the succession itself, but on the whole attitude to Muslim history. So for Abdullahi, the divisions of the Ummah started through hereditary succession, whereas for Bello, you know, division of the Ummah was basically a result of disloyalty to the strong leaders that emerged in his view through God's will. And so if you were going to rebel against the strongest candidate, then you're going against God's will. And so they looked to history to pick figures that they particularly respected. You know, Bello picked Suleiman the Magnificent, you know, because he was so powerful and had all this territory. Abdullahi held up the example of Umar II. He was one of the later Umayyad caliphs because he tried to return things to how they'd been in the time of the rightly guarded caliphs. So while there was all of this kind of higher intellectual discussion going on, there was complete confusion as to who actually was ruler of Sokoto after Usman died, because both Bello and Abdullahi claimed to be Amir al-Mu'mineen in their correspondences with all sorts of people from the region who wanted to find out what happened. You know, and then at the same time, you have the Hausa who feel that this is their chance to return the power that they'd lost in 1804. And so there's this, between 1817 and 1821, there's what we might call a second jihad, as you said, where Bello has to suppress all of these rebellions against him. So I hope I answered your question.
And then your final chapter kind of examines the rest of Bello's rule from 1821 to 1837. And one topic that will probably be familiar to anyone who has sort of ever been to northern Nigeria, and that's kind of the process of houseification, which has sort of already come up a bit. But yeah, kind of if you can expand on kind of what houseification was and kind of why did Bello undertake this as a strategy of rule?
Yeah, so when we think about Sokoto today, we kind of associate it, you know, with the House of Region and the House of People of northern Nigeria. But of course, it wasn't always like this. You know, Usman, Abdullahi, Bello, they were all identified as Fulani. They criticize a lot of these rituals of the House of Court structure, the House of Dress, House of Language, and wider aspects of the House of Culture, which they sought to change during that 1804 jihad. But Bello reversed a lot of these decisions, brought back the House of Court, encouraged the use of the House of Language, and House identity was literally replicated, you know, among the elites who had taken House of Wives, House of Concubines in that violent period of the jihad. So Bello's brother, who took over from him, Atiku, after he died, was Hausa. His mother was Hausa, so he was half Hausa himself. And so this process kind of just continued over the 19th century until Hausa became equivalent to, a state or a national identity, despite the fact that the original movement had been predominantly Fulani. So, you know, as to why this happened, I think it's because if you have this large court structure, this gives you lots of opportunities for patronage to basically buy the loyalty of people, as we saw between 1817 and 1821, who rebelled because they wanted to take back control. And so he was trying to buy the loyalty of the Hausa and, of course, of other powerful people, kind of to integrate them into the Sokoto system. And to see how well that worked, it might be worth comparing with Gwandu, which is a town that Abdullahi ruled after the jihad, kind of semi-independently of Sokoto. And so he kept this very strict Torobbe Fulani hierarchy. Fufulde was the language of government. He did not introduce any really outsiders from the wider population into the government. And it's quite clear that Gwandu only controlled really Gwandu City, and it didn't really have much influence in the wider region because there were essentially no opportunities for non-Fulani to advance in this system.
Another topic that you touch on is one that has been written about by other scholars of the Sokoto state, and that's slavery. So how did Bello understand the practice of slavery, and what policies did he put in place?
Yeah, so Bello wrote a history of the Hausa region in Falcon Mysore, where he talks about the different regions of Hausa land and different characteristics of the people and of the natural environment. And from this, although he doesn't make it explicit until some years later, from this it's pretty clear that Bello considered the regions to the south of the Hausa states, often called the Banza Bakwai or the False Seven, in contrast to the Hausa states, talking about areas such as Gwari, such as Bauchi, to be enslavable, their inhabitants were natural resources to be extracted for the use of Muslims. And he makes this very clear later on, but at the moment, you know, the Hausa states did the same thing. So essentially, he's just recycling enslavement patterns that existed in the region before the Fodiawa came to power. The difference was that he framed the practice of slavery within this written Islamic tradition of trying to categorize people into enslavable and non-enslavable groups based primarily on a geographic region, because the assumption was that they were Muslim or non-Muslim based on where they lived. And so after 1821, when Bello's kind of rule was assured and he didn't need to prove himself or cite any kind of authorities such as Ahmad Baba, whose fatwa had been very influential in the region for a long time, he said Ahmad Baba was wrong about Hausa land. Ahmad Baba had said that Hausa land was a land of Islam. Any captives from Hausa land, or in fact, he named several places in Hausa land, could not be legally enslaved. And so he said, look, this was written hundreds of years ago. Things have changed. I know the region more than he did. And he then dictates these groups inside Sokoto's territories and on the borders of Sokoto who could be enslaved. And so this information was passed directly to regional emirs who would receive captives from outside of Sokoto's borders, and they also had to send captives every year as tribute to Sokoto. So this was a direct policy document, which I think really has been overlooked in kind of setting enslavement patterns in Sokoto, which, of course, by the middle of the 19th century, had become, you know, one of the world's, if not the world's, largest slave society. So.
And then sort of relevant to current tensions with sort of in Nigerian politics, the early Sokoto state under Bello had policies that privileged populations that were sedentary at the expense of those populations that were nomadic. So why was this, and kind of how did Bello justify these policies?
Yes, he definitely did prioritize urbanization, sedentarization. This was part of his vision of an urban Muslim society. And just, you know, so we're talking about the nomadic groups in the region. We're talking about Tuareg and the nomadic Fulani. And his policy between these two groups was very different indeed, partly because he himself was Fulani, but also because, you know, during the original 1804 jihad, the Tuareg kind of vacillated between supporting the jihad and supporting the jihad's opponents, whereas the Fulani were very much on the Fodiawa's side. And so, you know, Bello considered nomadism a threat, a direct threat to this society he had in mind for Sokoto. But for the Tuareg, had to be their nomadism was unacceptable for Bello, and they had to be excluded from the Sokoto project. So he, from very early on, he portrayed them as treacherous, as immoral, you know, inherently a kind of foreign people who had to be controlled through violence and pushed out of Sokoto's borders. And then the Fulani, you know, Bello kind of tried to integrate them very early on through programs to sedentarize them, to move them to these new kind of fortress cities he was building on the outskirts of Sokoto, and also to educate them. He very much tried to standardize education, Muslim education, during this period. And there's many reasons for this. I mean, aside from his responsibilities, perhaps paternalistic responsibilities to educate his people, it was also very pragmatic. You know, urban centers are directly controlled by himself or his family members. They're much easier to control. They're much easier to defend. It's much easier to, when you move away from the clan structure of the nomadic Fulani, it's much easier to control his citizens. So I think it was again to try to avoid the rebellions that had faced him before, and really as a means of social control.
Now, while the bulk of the book is concerned with the textual production surrounding the early years of the Sokoto state, you know, as we've been talking, you're also clearly interested in the afterlife of these texts, particularly in terms of the politics of this history. So how have political concerns at different moments written or perhaps rewritten the early history of the Sokoto state? Or kind of another way of putting this is kind of how have different historical actors used or perhaps misused this history?
Yeah, no, thank you. That's good. Yeah, it's a good, important point that I hope is made clearly in the book, is that it is not so much a divergence of interpretations of Sokoto history, but if you look over about 200 years of engagement with the writings of the Fodiawa, there's this creation very early on of an official Sokoto history that evolves and is strengthened over time. And they very quickly became disconnected from the context in which these manuscripts are written, which, you know, was one. The reason why there's so much written material from Sokoto was because there was so much disagreement about the correct way to govern Muslim society, and disagreement between the Fodiawa on a personal level. That's why there's so much writing. But from very, very early on, these manuscripts were used to create an official history of Sokoto. And whether we're talking about the later generations of the Sokoto elite that ruled after Bello, whether we're talking about the British colonial authorities, and whether we're talking about early nationalist Nigerian politicians, they all had the same aim in mind, was basically to aggrandize the early history of Sokoto, emphasize the unity and the good governance of the Fodiawa in order to justify the hereditary rule of the Sokoto elite, or of the British who ruled through them, or Nigerian politicians such as Ahmadu Bello, Bello's great grandson, who wanted to use this legacy on the basis, you know, to further his own claims to lead the region into independence.
And even too, you mentioned there's also sort of anti-Sufi groups like Zala have kind of made reference, as well as even Boko Haram sort of more recently. I mean, how have they kind of connected to this history as well?
Yeah, they have, because it's interesting to see, you know, through history that Boko Haram, you know, is also trying to overthrow the current Nigerian government. They also claim that this government is non-Muslim. They also claim that good Muslims should follow them in order to overthrow this government. But they are really taking from a kind of global jihadi Salafi lens rather than through a Qadiri Sufi lens, you know. So in that respect, they're very different, but the basic narrative is the same, I would say. And so everybody tries to interpret you know, the past in a way that suits their present. It's normal to see that, and it's not surprising to see Boko Haram and other groups use this legacy.
Related to this, I know that a side interest of yours is sort of how the legacy of the Sokoto Caliphate has been taken up by Muslim groups in the Americas as well as Europe. So what is the history of this history outside of Nigeria and West Africa?
Yeah, so it was been very interesting when I moved temporarily to the States to do my research into the book. I found that there was a community of Muslims in Pittsburgh called the Nur al-Zaman, who were actually translating and teaching 40-hour texts in the community and also in the U.S. prison system. Not the same texts that I'm using in my book. These are mostly, you know, Sufi texts, spiritual texts, guide to praying and doing all of the basic rituals of Islam correctly. But it's interesting because they had also read Mervyn Hiskett's The Sword of Truth, which is a kind of popular history of the jihad. And it's easy to see why this kind of blend of social reform, spiritual renewal, and a connection to Africa would appeal to various groups around the world. And so many of the members of this group had been members of the Nation of Islam, but they were looking for a spiritual rather than a political dimension to the faith, and also, you know, a connection to the African continent that was noble, and it was not connected to the slave trade and any of the other, you know, terrible things that happened in the past. And so they took this you know, this very interesting perspective. That's one example. The other one I talk about in the book is in the Russian Federation. I know less about this example, but in this case, it is very interesting because it's the opposite phenomenon. So it's essentially mostly white Russian converts to Islam who have actually adopted Maliki law, which is used in West Africa, and made connections with all sorts of groups in South Africa and also in West Africa to distance themselves from Muslims who are from the Caucasus and from Central Asia who are established in Russia. So it's an attempt. The first attempt is an attempt to find a kind of an identity in the US. And the second attempt is, you know, taking Usman as an othering factor to move yourself apart from other Muslims. So it's very interesting to see these two dynamics that I'd like to research more.
Right. Now that we've sort of gone through the book, could you reflect on what you see as the key interventions your research makes in Sokoto studies?
So I really hope that my book has shown how Sokoto studies can be brought out of this very narrow frame of reference that speaks only to present day Nigeria, and how it's really connected to this very wide, very dynamic West African discursive space that was occurring all across the region. So just in, you know, my work with the Hill Museum, we keep coming across 40-hour texts in Timbuktu that were copied, you know, only a year or two after Usman or wrote them in Hausa land. And so there's the much wider conversation going on that is not just about the future northern Nigeria, but you know, I would really like to see an end to it being parceled off into a national history rather than a regional history. So that's one point. And I also wanted to show how we can engage differently with these writings, not just from the Fodiawa, but any kind of this manuscript heritage of West Africa. And so not using them to add to this already oversaturated narrative about the chronology of the early history of this of Sokoto in this case, but saying, you know, look, these manuscripts are unreliable as historical sources. You know, they're the history of the victor. But what can they tell us? How can they be useful? Well, they're written to legitimize political and intellectual projects. So I think that they can tell us what legitimacy meant in the 19th century Sahel and how it could be won, how it could be lost, how it evolved over time. And so, yes, the history of Sokoto is unique and it's influenced by the local setting. But these writings engage with much larger ideas that can help us understand political change across different Muslim societies in the world.
I'm also wondering if you might reflect a bit on your methods. So how did you identify your sources? What are the different ways that you use them? And kind of how did you go about sort of organizing them into a coherent narrative? So basically, yeah, I'm curious about kind of what the actual method looked like.
Yeah, the process. Yeah, I mean, it just involves, looking into, Brill has this series, Arabic Literature of Africa, and John Hunwick and others have done a really amazing job at cataloging all of the excellent manuscript copies. I mean, through my job, I've found some more, but it's pretty extensive. And so I needed to look at those manuscripts that I thought would be relevant to these discourses of legitimation and the evolving discourse over time. And try to follow in a chronological way how these arguments and how these discourses change. And so some of these manuscripts have dates, others can be assumed by context. And as you start to identify the dates of some of them, you know, the rest of them kind of come together. So I have a reasonably confident chronology now of these writings. And so the chapters of my book were really imposed by the manuscripts themselves and the discourse of dissent, the discourse of moderation, you know, other terms that I use in the books were really an attempt to group these manuscripts and the arguments within them together over the chronological period. And so in that way, it kind of wrote itself, at least the structure part.
I'm also curious if you might kind of share what some of the challenges were, you know, of doing this type of work, particularly in terms of source analysis or sort of simply tracking down the actual copies of some of these sources.
Yes, tracking down the copies of them was quite difficult. Much easier than it would have been, a few decades ago. Thanks to this really kind of explosion of cataloging more recently of digitization. I did spend several months in Niger working with the National Archives there. Because of funding and also because of security issues, I couldn't travel to Northern Nigeria, the places that I wanted to go to get some copies that did not exist in other places. And so I just had to shut off those conversations in my book because I didn't have the manuscript material. But that only happened, there were only kind of two or three that I really wanted to get and couldn't find. You know, as for the analysis, you know, nobody had really worked with the manuscripts in this way of, you know, not just extracting bits of information to use in your narrative, but really to appreciate it as a whole document that had an audience, that had a context, that was being talked and debated and written about by contemporaries. And so it took a lot of patience to just sit down with these documents and try to imagine all of this context and having to really kind of block out a lot of what I'd read about the historiography of Sokoto, trying to return to that context. So this work will get easier with digitization, but then that also brings up the question it brings up a lot of different issues. If these collections are all digitized, you know, my book was far richer and far more, just personally more fulfilling because I did travel to Niger and other places and talked to scholars. And I'm just worried that if these manuscripts are available in your living room, all of these conversations between Western scholars, between African scholars will not happen. So I'm also a bit cautious about the future of opening up all this heritage.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Naylor, we've taken up enough of your time, but before we end, I'd like to ask you one more question, and that's kind of what you're working on currently, or also kind of where do you see Sokoto studies kind of going in the future?
Yeah, so I, as you mentioned at the beginning, I work for the Hill Museum Manuscript Library, and I'm in the process with my colleague Ali Jakite of cataloging digitized manuscripts from around 26 family libraries in Timbuktu. So this will be over 250,000, maybe 300,000 items. So this is going to keep me busy for quite a long time. I'm also translating some of the 40-hour text that I didn't cover in my book. So I just had a piece out in Islamic Africa recently about Mohamed Bello's Curriculum of Study, a book where he mentions all of his teachers, all of the works that he studied with them and that hadn't been translated or made as a critical edition so far. And I'm also translating a series of fawaid or kind of recipes for popular medicine for it's called the Maktaba Project. So this is going to showcase a number of manuscripts from the Northwestern University's Herskovitz Library and also the collection at UIUC for students to use in the classroom. So it will be the manuscript itself, an English translation, and all sorts of points to help students understand these texts directly. So that's what definitely I'd like to do more of going forward, so that it's not just me, you know, reading this stuff, that it's available to a much wider audience.
Well, that all sounds really interesting. Thanks so much for doing the interview.
Sure. Yeah, anytime.